Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I'm Robin Proud. I'm a member of the program committee. Prairie aspires to be an open-hearted and an open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, gender, or family structure. We welcome you no matter what your age, your abilities, or inabilities. Later in the service, we'll invite visitors and guests or returning friends to introduce yourselves if you wish to. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of programs. Sometimes they're presented by a member, sometimes by our minister, Sandy Ingham, and sometimes, as today, a member of the wider community. For our opening words, please welcome Patty.
I think that this is a conflict of interest to ask men and women elected from the districts to change the lines of that district. President Ronald Reagan.
For our chalice lighting, Bob and Barb Park. This light we kindle is set in the lamp of our history. We inherit this free faith from brave and gentle, fierce and outspoken hearts and minds that have come before us. Let us be worthy inheritors of this faith, and through our good works, pass it boldly to the next generation. Odette Fulbright Folsom.
Well, I'm personally very happy to have our speaker today. One indulgence I have is I get the New York Times every day on paper. And I'm amazed at how often when an expert is quoted in a major article on, say, economics, political science, or various fields, the person that is quoted as an expert is from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And I keep sending those things to Penny saying, see if this person can speak, because we have such a wealth of opportunity here. And our speaker today fits into that category. Jordan Ellenberg grew up in Potomac, Maryland, the child of two statisticians. He excelled in mathematics from a young age and competed for the U.S. in the International Mathematical Olympiad 3 times, winning 2 gold medals and a silver. He went to college at Harvard, got a master's degree in fiction, writing from Johns Hopkins. I didn't see that one coming. And then returned to Harvard for his PhD in math. After graduate school, he was a postdoc at Princeton. In 2004, he joined the faculty of the University of Wisconsin at Madison, where he's now the John D. MacArthur Professor of Mathematics. Ellenberg's research centers on the fields of number theory and algebraic geometry, the parts of mathematics which address fundamental questions about algebraic equations and their solutions in whole numbers. Ellenberg's research has uncovered new and unexpected connections between these subjects and algebraic topology, the study of abstract, high-dimensional shapes and relations between them. Ellenberg was a plenary speaker at the 2013 Joint Mathematics Meetings, the largest mathematics conference in the world, and he has lectured around the United States and in 10 other countries. He's held an NSF Career Grant and an Alfred P. Sloan Fellowship. In 2013, he was named one of the inaugural class of Fellows of the American Mathematical Society, and in 2015, he was named a Guggenheim Fellow. Ellenberg has been writing for a general audience about math for more than 15 years. His work has appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, Wired, The Believer, and the Boston Globe, and he's the author of the Do the Math column in Slate. His Wired feature story on compressed sensing appeared in the Best Writing on Mathematics 2011 anthology, and his novel, The Grasshopper King, was a finalist for the 2004 New York Public Library Young Lions Fiction Award. He lives in Madison with his wife and 2 children, and he's going to talk to us today about mathematics and gerrymandering. So please welcome Jordan.
Hi guys, well thank you so much for welcoming me into your community. So I just want to talk a little bit today about this subject of gerrymandering and redistricting, which sounds a little bit like a sort of very arcane and intricate and technical subject, and that's because it is, but it's also actually of very great importance that I want to kind of elucidate that a little bit today. So let me just remind you how this works. So every 10 years, we have a census. And so every 10 years, we draw new assembly districts. So here in Wisconsin, our assembly has 99 members. Actually, maybe I'll stop here because it's an interesting question. Why do we have 99 assembly representatives? Like, why not 100? Wouldn't that be more even? Anybody know? How come it's 99?
3 times 33.
Exactly, because it's in the constitution of this state that there needs to be 3 assembly reps for each state senate district. So it has to be a multiple of 3. It can't be 100. Could be 102 someday, but it can't be 100. Anyway, we have 99 assembly districts, and each of those has to have approximately the same population. And so when there's a census, a new official population for the state, the boundaries of those districts have to change. Otherwise, districts in parts of the state where the population was growing, like the part where you're sitting right now, would have more and more people, and districts where the population was shrinking, like much of the northern third of the state, would get much, much smaller. Okay, why is that bad, by the way? Equal representation, that's right, because if you have one district with a much smaller number of people and one district with a much larger number of people, then the district with a larger number of people, each of those people proportionally has less representation in making the laws of our state. But I want to emphasize, by the way, that it was only in 1964 that principle was formalized by the Supreme Court in the case of Reynolds versus Sims. So until then, it was perfectly permissible for legislative districts to have different numbers of people. Well, there's so many different directions we could go with this because, you know, when I look up at the 7 principles and think about how they fit in with what I want to talk about, of course, we're really talking about justice and we're talking about equity, right? And so this speaks to this question, is everyone fairly represented? But even there, even if we weren't talking about redistricting, there's a lot we could talk about. Because when you say each district has the same population, what does that mean? Does that mean the total number of people who live there? Does it mean people of voting age? Does it mean people who are actually registered to vote? Anybody know this one, by the way? What the answer is, what we use?
Total.
It's total people, right? And the principle we use is that all the people who live there, whether they vote or not, whether they're a child or an adult, whether they're a citizen or not, are represented by that representative, and the representative is meant to serve their interest, and so that's the standard we use. But I'll just emphasize that, like, someone in government who wanted it to be a different way could certainly choose to make it a different way. There's all kinds of cases, as you may know, of districts which contain large state prisons, folks who are not allowed to vote while they're imprisoned there, but they count as, in terms of the population, because they do reside in that district, and they give those districts, you could well argue, greater representation for the non-imprisoned people who live within those boundaries. So there's a lot of places we can go. None of that is what I'm going to talk about, but it's like, I just want to emphasize that these technicalities of voting are actually like really important and actually really do matter for justice and equity, and sometimes they involve like counting and spreadsheets and the kind of stuff that maybe are not as popular as they could be. And as a math teacher, you know, we try to give people, I'm going off topic, but I mean, what we do when we teach math at a university or in high school or wherever we teach math is we are trying to give the people who are interested in justice and equity and those things the tools to do that work, because without the mathematical tools, there are certain parts of that work that you simply can't do. So, okay, end of speech about math education. So we have this principle, this enshrined constitutional principle that the districts have to have the same size so that everyone's interests are equally represented. And the sad truth is that that's not enough. That's what we now know. So now I'm going to draw some numbers on this board, and we'll kind of look at them and talk about them, okay? And we'll kind of have a little interactive moment here. Okay, so what I want you to imagine is a state with a population of 100. You know, we're doing an example, we're trying to make the numbers a little smaller. So there's 100 people in this state, and they're divided 60 and 40 between two major parties. Let's say the purple party and the orange party. I only have one marker, so you'll have to imagine. But and in this state, there are 5 congressional districts, okay? Well, okay, there's 100 people in the state. There's 5 congressional districts. So how much population should each district have? Only the kids. I only want one of the kids to. Oh, is there only one kid left? Where'd all the other kids go? Oh, okay, I don't want to pick on you just because you're the only kid. Okay. Do you know how many people should live in each district if I have to split 100 into 5?
105 between put this kid on the spot. That's so unfair. Okay. Well, how many people should live in each district? Yeah, okay, that's good. Yeah. As a new resident of this state, I mean, I'm working. Every year I get a little better at drawing this. I've been here 13 years now. You should have seen it when I first came. My Door County was like this big, like a big tentacle. I'm slowly starting to get it.
If it's a state of 100 people,
mm-hmm.
then I would do maybe 25.
Well, but 25, then once I had four districts, I'd run out of people, right? Because 25 times 4 is 100. So I need 20. I need 20 in each district. But let me show you different ways. I'm going to write down three different ways they can be apportioned. Okay, so ready? Here we go. I've got my notes here so I can remember what to write. Here's one way it could look. Okay, so you'll notice that each district has 20 people, and three of them are very lopsidedly in favor of the purple party, like 15 purple voters and only 5 orange voters. And then you have two districts which are more weighted in favor of the orange party. Okay, here's two more ways it could look. Hopefully I did these right so these add up. You guys can check my work in your head. And then here's yet another way. Okay, so let's sort of contemplate this for a moment and you can verify for yourself that in each of these cases, if I add these numbers up, I correctly have 60 purple voters and 40 orange voters. But if I look at how the assembly would be made up in each of the under each of these configurations, it's actually rather different because here, I'm going to have the purple party is going to win 3 seats and the orange party is going to win 2. Here, the orange party is going to win 3 seats and the purple party is going to win 2. And here, the purple party actually wins all 5 seats and the orange party is unrepresented entirely in the state. Despite actually having like a sort of substantial number of adherents to that party in the state's population. So what I want to do now is just actually take a second and try to decide for yourself how you would rank these apportionments from most to least fair. Because that's the question before us, right? What's fair? What counts as equity? What counts as representation for all the citizens of this state? So let's actually think about it for a second, like what you would say. Okay, and if you've thought about it now if you could, let's just take maybe 1 or 2 minutes and like turn to the person next to you and see if you guys have the same idea about what you think is most fair and what you think is least fair. And if you don't, and usually there is a lot of dispute about this point, see if you can come to some kind of agreement or at least understand what the principles are on which your seatmate is judging. So let's do that, and then we'll reconvene in like 2 minutes. Okay, so let's reconvene and like see where we are. Okay, so let's first ask which we like best. So which of these maps do we think is the most fair? Who likes this one? Okay, that's usually pretty popular. Who likes this one? Okay, a few people. Who likes this one? Okay, good. So every map has at least a few parts. Okay, let's do who likes. I want to know which one people think is the worst. Okay, which is the most unfair map on this list? Who thinks it's this one? Okay, no haters for this map. Who thinks this is the most unfair? A decent number. Who thinks this is the most unfair? Now I want to launch into like a long psychoanalysis of the Unitarian Universalist movement. Well, no, because I will say with most groups I do this exercise with, I would say most people, I would say, and there's no right or wrong answer here, by the way. I don't want to just to ruin the punchline. Like, we're here to figure out what we mean by fair and unfair. But I would say in general, people find this one the most unfair because the party that has the majority in the state is in the minority in the legislature. But you guys are like, you know what's really unfair when like one group of people is completely shut out from any representation whatsoever? Like better the wrong party should be in the majority than that one group should be completely silent. So I mean, we can, That's pretty interesting, actually, because it was like pretty dominant choice in this room. Okay. So I'm not going to answer the question of like which is most fair and which is most unfair. I mean, I think in this particular example, I sort of stacked the deck a little bit in the favor of this kind of map, which I think what map typically looks like. I will say that this map features a phenomenon that was called proportional representation, which means that if you see, I cooked it so that literally exactly 60% of the seats are held by the party that holds 60% of the population. That's too much to hope for, and in fact, there are actually reasons to think that that's probably in some way not what would happen naturally under neutrally defined maps. So I think if you look at this mathematically, typically parties which have a popular majority will typically have a majority of seats that's slightly larger than their popular majority. But still, like, this looks pretty good. But what I want to show you by doing this exercise is that how you apportion the voters into districts has a huge effect on how the legislature looks. Even though each district is the same size, so even though each person has sort of exactly the same power within their own district, these are three radically different outcomes that can come from districts drawn within the existing laws. And I think for obvious reasons, a lot of people see that as a big problem, especially because, as we heard from the quote from Reagan at the beginning, the people who are deciding where those boundaries should be drawn are the people who currently sit in the legislature. So the people who have a very direct interest in where those lines are drawn and preserving both their party's status and their own status. I think this picture also, it kind of really shows you, I hope, like in a pretty gut level way, how gerrymandering works. Like, what do you want to do? If you are the party which maybe doesn't have the majority of the population, but wants to lock in a majority for your party in the legislature, what do? You try to pack the voters from the other party into as few districts as possible. So look what happens here. How did Orange manage to attain this majority? By taking as many purple voters as they could and stuffing them into these districts, which are almost all purple already, so that those votes are, if you like, wasted. At least they're wasted in the sense that they don't contribute to the purple party getting more seats in the legislature. I mean, this could be 20-0, right? And that would be end of the same seats, and it would only make these seats more orange. So so what do we do about this? I mean, this is, so as you may know, our own assembly districts, which I'm gonna be honest with you, are drawn in a way that is essentially like this. So I mean, there's not time to tell the whole sordid story. And it's not exactly like this because Wisconsin, as you may know, is not a state where 60% of the population are adherents of one political party. Wisconsin is a state that is almost exactly evenly split between members of the two major parties. And of course, there are other parties too. I see like one guy with a neither elephant nor ass shirt in the back, so I feel like I have to give a shout out to third partyism and say, right, so if you think this is ridiculous, remember that if you support any party other than Republicans or Democrats, this is your life, yeah. Right? No matter what. So it's not actually that outlandish from the point of view of somebody who's not from one of the major two parties, because while even if that party has, you know, more than 1% of the population of Wisconsin, they're not going to get their one or two seats in the legislature, right? That's not going to happen under our current system. So our map here in Wisconsin was drawn this way. There's ample sort of subpoenaed evidence that shows that it was drawn intentionally this way, intentionally to pack Democratic voters into a few districts and to all but lock in a Republican majority in the assembly. That case, our map was thrown out by a district court, went to the US Supreme Court, where the case was essentially sort of put in limbo on a kind of technicality. So we don't really have an answer yet whether our assembly maps here in Wisconsin are in violation of the U.S. Constitution. But I'm going to be honest with you. I would say reading the decision that the Supreme Court made, I think they're in a legal landscape where it will be very difficult to overturn our maps. I'm not a lawyer, so I don't want to sort of talk in detail about the law, but I want to say I think that the Supreme Court has all but said that it's going to be very difficult for courts to step in. So let me say a little bit about this from a mathematical point of view. You know, first of all, why is this suddenly a problem now? Are like politicians like just meaner and more venal and more corrupt and more like hungry python-like than they used to be? When we were kids, no, I think politicians were kind of always like that. I think there actually is a kind of mathematical and technical and computational difference, which is that, you know, I talked to a fellow named Kevin Kennedy. I don't know if you guys know him, but he was the head of the Government Accountability Board when we had a Government Accountability Board, as some of you will remember. And he's been involved with elections in this state for a long time. And he said, we have always had gerrymandering. We have always had legislators trying to cook the map to their own party advantage. What that used to look like, he said there would always be like some like weird guy who knew like every ward and every precinct, and they would have a giant map of Wisconsin, and like that person would draw the map, right? That's the way it used to be, and you can get yourself an advantage that way, but here's how it looks now. Here's how it looked in 2011 when these maps were drawn, and we know this, I'm not making it up, we know this because of the documents we subpoenaed and the emails that we saw. It's now very easy to fire up a computer and look at 10,000 possible maps. And within seconds, just sort of pick out of those 10,000, the one that maximally advantages your party. You could do 10,000, you could do 100,000, you could do whatever you want. And if you want to make sure you don't run afoul of the Voting Rights Act or any other laws controlling the way districts look, you can do that too. You program that in. So I'll emphasize, you know, if you've read something about gerrymandering, you may think what gerrymandering is about is drawing these very crazy shaped districts that wind and wend their way all over the state, again, much like a hungry python, and which are drawn, I mean, but you don't have to do that. I want to emphasize, if you tell your computer, make me nicely round shaped districts that don't look funny, but nonetheless give my party a huge advantage, I promise you can do that. And that is what's done. And if you look at our districts here in Wisconsin, they actually don't look particularly weird. But they are, in fact, drawn to advantage one party very strongly. The best analysis I've seen, which is from a team out of Duke, says that for Democrats to win 50% of the assembly seats in this state, they would have to win the popular vote by somewhere between 8 to 12 points. They would have to get between 54 and 56% of the popular vote. And that's a very heavy lift in an evenly split state like Wisconsin. It's actually very rare you see either a Democratic or a Republican candidate win that much of the vote here in Wisconsin. So it certainly doesn't make it impossible for Democrats to take control of the assembly, but I think there's no question that it makes it extremely difficult. Okay, so that's how, now I feel like I've sort of bashed on math a little bit because I told you how better math and better computers makes it easier for politicians to do their mischief. I also want to emphasize that there's math on the other side of this too. And I think mathematical techniques also make it easier for us to look at an existing map and say, hey, this map just isn't fair. We can like, how is this done? Well, okay, if you, the corrupt politician, looking out for your party's advantage, can make 10,000 maps and pick out the one that's best for you, I, the crusading mathematician, can also make 10,000 maps. I can make 10,000 random maps drawn without reference to improving one party's position over the other. And I can present to the judge and be like, hey, look, here's 10,000 random maps, and here's the map that you're actually using. And look how, like, of all those maps, the one that we're actually using happens to be the one that maximally advantages this party. At about, you know, what's the chance? Is that coincidence? Is that, so as mathematicians, I think we're very, I mean, you know, maybe, I mean, you gotta figure we're soon gonna get past the days when corrupt politicians are dumb enough to keep emailing themselves about what they're doing, right? I mean, we have those documents in Wisconsin. We have them in Michigan in the case that's going on right now there, but I think we're not gonna have them together. I think people will wise up about their record keeping. And so I think, we're also entering in an area where we can detect gerrymandering and measure its effects much more effectively than we can do before. I'll give you one example of this. Is that here's something, and I've read all these cases, and I've you know, talked to the people in Wisconsin who defend our maps. One thing they'll say is, well, look, you know, we're not doing anything on purpose. Our state just is that way. Our state just looks like this because you have very dense concentrations of Democrats in the two big cities in the state, Madison and Milwaukee, and so you have a lot of districts that look like this. You know what I mean? Like, here where like 85% of the vote is going to go to one party's candidate. And I can tell you that the ward I live in West Madison, more than 85% of the vote goes to one candidate. So it's not like that doesn't exist. Not in my whole assembly district. Not at all. Are you guys in 77? I live in 77. Okay, so. Okay. But are we right now here situated in 77? I don't.
Oh, 76.
76, okay. So that merits, that argument, I want to emphasize, it has a certain amount of merit. And I think that if you looked at a neutrally drawn map here in Wisconsin, and if exactly 50% of the population voted for Republicans and exactly 50% of the population voted for Democrats, and like you voted for whoever you vote for. if that were the case, the Republicans would have an assembly majority, a pretty small one, but I think it kind of gives you about a 2% swing. But the point is that with these mathematical tools that we now have, we can exactly assess that argument. We can say it's not just because a lot of Democrats are piled up in Madison and Milwaukee. That explains about 2% of the kind of 8 to 12% advantage that the Republicans have currently given themselves. So that's kind of where, that's all the math I really want to talk about. That's kind of where the math comes in on both sides of this. We know that sometimes I go, if I have longer, I go deeper, we talk about random walks and et cetera. I can talk about anybody who wants to after. But I do want to say this. I'm going to slightly, I think like a lot of people, especially the people here in Madison who worked very hard on this case, the Supreme Court kind of really declining to step in was like pretty disappointing. But I do want to say that there's a way in which they have a point. And that is this. I mean, what the people here in Wisconsin defending our map will tell you is, you know, this is a political question. And this is something the court should step in and decide. If the people don't like this, like the people should speak through the representatives, the people should speak through their vote. Yes, there's a barrier being erected to that. It's like sort of spoken out of both sides of the mouth, but that's the statement. And I think the court is kind of saying the same thing. And it's a good reminder that even though the court is called the justice system, it's not guaranteed to deliver justice in every situation. It's very limited in what they can do. So I think the court's decision, if you read it, it doesn't defend gerrymandering. It doesn't say this process is healthy for democracy. It kind of says this process is corrupt, it's anti-democratic, it stinks, and it's unfair. But it's not unfair in an unconstitutional way. It's just unfair in a dirty, stinky, undemocratic way that the Constitution doesn't forbid. And as a court, our job is only to forbid what the Constitution forbids and not to bring justice beyond that. So I mean, this vision of the court's role is that in the end, it's people's and communities' job to bring justice and bring equity into our politics. That any system of laws can only go so far in guaranteeing that. The law can't guarantee equity and the law can't guarantee justice without people's help. So, I mean, I'm not going to say I agree with the court's decision. I don't, to be honest. But I do think there's a point to saying that we can't rely on courts to make things completely fair in our politics. This is going to play out differently in different states, but I want to emphasize that around the country, you are seeing, in Michigan you see it, in Colorado you see it, you are seeing ballot initiatives, popular referendums, where hundreds of thousands of people have signed petitions to get something on the November ballot saying the people are going to go around the legislature and change the state constitution to create an independent commission to draw those districts. And we're looking very closely at those states to see what happens there. Now, of course, by the way, the same people who said the courts should not get in the way to change our map here are suing to get the courts to stop them from putting that on the ballot in Michigan, because certainly they don't actually want the people to decide. That's another matter. But we'll see. We don't have a ballot initiative process here in Wisconsin, which I think overall is to the good, to be honest, because it's not really the greatest way to make policy. But I think this is an issue where most people, whatever party they belong to, understand that the current system is, once they know what it is like pretty corrupt and smelly and not democratic, and they don't like it. I think this is an issue where there is political space to create equity, and I think there is political space for a movement here in Wisconsin, one which already exists. I'm not fantasizing, right? There's a movement called Fair Maps. They've gone around in 37 counties, which is 70% of the state, not 70% of the counties, but 70% of the population of the state. 37 county boards have passed resolutions asking the state legislature to create independent redistricting. You have states like Ohio, where the Republican power structure has sort of just accepted that it's too stinky and there's reform there, like led by their extremely conservative governor, John Kasich. So I think this is possible. I don't think it's hopeless. And I guess what I'd like to say, not speaking as a mathematician, but speaking as a citizen of this state, that we can take the court saying we're not going to help you, not as a defeat, but as a challenge that we can rise to. That we're going to say, like, okay, it's up to the people of this state, the communities of this state, the voters of this state, and even if they'll pick up the darn phone, the politicians of this state, to do a better job. So I'll stop there and take questions. Thank you guys so much. So the op-ed, I'll sort of answer that question. I don't know if it was meant rhetorically. When you ask, why do we do it by maps?
Yes.
I mean, the reason is that's what the state constitution says that we do, and state constitutions are really hard to amend. So in a lot of these cases, we are thinking about, and this is, as a mathematician, talking to people who work on elections and lawyers who work on elections, you really learn that as a mathematician, you're like, oh, let's just sort of like start from complete zero and imagine what would be the right system. But as a lawyer, you can't do that, right? Because there are constitutions. Constitutions are hard to change. I think it's actually kind of good that constitutions are hard to change. I mean, that's sort of by design. But that does mean that I do feel like we are, is this too defeatist? I feel like we are kind of locked into this geographic system of representation. I mean, my guess is that every state constitution locks this in. I don't know. I know Wisconsin's does, because I've read the relevant parts. Into the sort of exact mechanics, there is like a sort of a metric called the efficiency gap, which counts, so to speak, wasted votes. I didn't really computer on the board this time. It was developed by a political science professor at the University of Chicago. I think it has virtues, but I also think it has serious deficits.
What are they?
As a measure. Well, okay, so what this, so for instance, what this metric does, okay, can I use a math word? It's highly discontinuous in the following sense, that here, all 9 of these votes would count as wasted votes for the Purple Party under this efficiency gap metric that some cases have used. Because those 9 voters like didn't generate any seats. On the other hand, a very small change, if this were 11 to 9 instead of 9 to 11, that's almost the same story of the election, but suddenly those 9 votes were not wasted at all, and suddenly there's 9 votes over here that are wasted. So it's very sensitive to very small changes, and I think that's bad. If you're trying to like measure how fair a map is, the answer to that question shouldn't radically change because of like one very small shift of votes in one.
Given, so what is a better metric?
I think a better metric is this system. Now it's more complicated, but I think the system where you're like, okay, let's take the map that's used and like let's look at like 10,000 computer-generated similar maps and note that of all those maps, the one that they actually used is radically more favorable to one party than all the random ones. That to me is like a very clear red flag signal, and it's very visible. You know, you see these some of these testimonies that come into the expert witnesses for these cases. You know, you'll see they'll draw a chart. Okay, here's 10,000 maps I made, and like, here's how many seats Democrats win in these very, you know, there's sort of more in the middle, maybe you have a kind of like a bell curve kind of a deal, and then here's the actual map, and it's like out here, and it's very visceral, and you just see it, and you're like, okay, it's like, you know, when you see like the dead body with chalk around it, you're like, ah, something, foul play. So I do think that's like a better system. And in cases like the case in Pennsylvania, where the Supreme Court threw out their map, not on U.S. constitutional grounds, but on grounds of the Pennsylvania state constitution, so that's immune to any of these issues about our Supreme Court. It was really this kind of analysis that held the day.
Thank you.
So I don't know the answer to that question. I don't think there should be a question about citizenship on the census, because I think there's no question about both the intent and the effect of adding that question is to encourage people who ought to be counted not to be counted. And I think actually there's like a long history of avoiding reforms that would help us better count the people who are not counted by the census, who are differentially poor, who are differentially non-white, and who are differentially urban. I mean, that's a long story. But I don't actually have any empirical knowledge of like which states I think would be most affected by that. And I also don't know if it's gonna happen or not. You know, the government throws a lot of stuff at the wall, and it's like, amazing how much stuff they say they're gonna do and then don't actually do. So we don't know. We don't know how it'll look. And actually, I should have said that, you know, in the earlier case law on this, so Sandra Day O'Connor wrote like an important opinion about this stuff back in the 80s, where she was like, you know, like, yes, this is unfair and smelly and not democratic, but you know, like, people move and people change their political allegiances, and maybe you can kind of do better in one election like this, but then it's going to fade out. You know, you sort of made your measurements and you drew your line right after the census, but then it's going to fade out. I think there is actually, I think, and political scientists would say, there's actually a difference between the 80s and now. I think people are more rigidly locked into their party ID now than they were in the 80s. So I think by all accounts, it is much more possible now for me to look at a map of Wisconsin and predict how certain regions are going to vote over the, you know, 6 years from now. I think that's more possible now than it was 35 years ago, because I think people are actually more locked into their party ID now. You have fewer swing voters, fewer people who are changing their identification. So it's a good question, and it kind of depends on what you're trying to privilege. So if you were to ask, what do we mean when we say a district is weirdly shaped? That's a kind of topological question. So my friends who work on that kind of thing are topologists and geometers, right? Because they're the ones who study shapes. If you ask the question, what would these districts look like if they were chosen at random? That's fundamentally a probability and statistics question, right? Because it's, so I can tell you, if to say like one geeky thing, if you want to know what is like the actual big challenge, is that if you were like, well, what if we just like literally chose a district at random from all the legally admissible ways of dividing Wisconsin into 99 districts? You can't do it. There's too many ways. Like, there's no, you literally cannot actually just choose a random one from all of those, because just to list them all would like take all the computers in the world, like the lifetime of the universe. So you have to develop some kind of statistical proxy for generating a pretty random looking map. And you know what you mean by that, that's probability right there. So I think I would say the most of the people I know who work on this are, I would say they're populists. Right, so I should have said, first of all, racial gerrymandering is its own story. And I should have said, right, there's a lot of, and a very different case law about that particular case. Now, Watertownian Americans are not a protected class constitutionally, so there's there's sort of like different law about it. But I don't think I get what you mean. Like who would make that happen? Would the mayor of Watertown go to the state legislature and be like, my city all wants to be in one district, make that happen? Like, what would be their leverage in doing that? I mean, you know, one thing, so I will say this, if you look in the state constitution about how those districts are to be drawn, there are rules saying, hey, you shouldn't split cities, you shouldn't split counties, you shouldn't cross county lines. But, so, okay, if you're a mathematician, and you're like, I'm going to, like, read the laws, you kind of expect it to be like math, and you're like, okay, here are the rules, we follow these rules. And then you actually, like, read the Constitution of Wisconsin, and there's, like, a lot of suggestions. It's actually not very much like math. So it kind of says, like, yeah, to the extent practical, like, you shouldn't cut city boundaries and you shouldn't cut counties. But guess what? They do. And the current map we have, it cuts lots of county boundaries. That's part of the way that it works. And I don't think those provisions really have very much force. I think it's a really interesting question to me. I mean, I think it's something which it's a bit science fictional because the constitution we have in the state doesn't allow for it, but it's still very worth asking, would that be fair? I mean, I'll say this, like, you know, as you may know, I'm Jewish, I have relatives in Israel, so I follow their politics pretty closely. They have a more parliamentary system. I don't wake up in the morning and envy Israeli politics and wish our politics were like theirs. Like, because you do, you have a different set of problems, right? I mean, you have a different set of problems that comes with a parliamentary system, and I actually, it's not clear to me that it's more fair. I think it's unfair in a different way. I mean, one thing that happens is you have very small groups joined by like a very particular interest
who have incredibly outsized power because they sort of hold the balance between bigger groups. I don't mean to pick on Israel. I mean, that's true in every parliamentary system. It's true in England. Like, it seems to be, I mean, it seems to be less true in Canada. Those people are just, like, nice or something. I don't know how they manage it. But, I mean, so yeah, in math, we always talk about the bump in the rug. You know, we're like, there's some problem here. Like, something's not working. Oh, I see. There's like a bump in the rug. Just like push it down. Well, guess what? The bump goes somewhere else. So if I thought there was a perfect system, I'd be going around advocating for that. But I mean, I think we can at least take the system that we're constitutionally locked into and try to make it as fair as it can be. And to say another thing, by the way, I want to emphasize, I talk about Republicans a lot because we're here in Wisconsin and our map was drawn by Republicans and gerrymandered to favor Republicans. I don't think Democratic politicians are that much nicer or less venal than Republican politicians, to be honest. And there are cases, you know, there's a case in Maryland that was heard by the Supreme Court, but it's where I'm from, my home state, a state run by Democrats. And what I promise, that state was drawn just, that those maps were drawn just as ruthlessly and just as unfairly by Democrats in that state to lock Republicans out of any representation as the maps here are drawn in favor of Republicans. If we don't fix this, I mean, you could say, like, okay, at some point, like, the Democrats will get back in charge and then it'll get fixed. No, it won't get fixed because if you've been having a boot stomp in your face for the last like 10 years and you're a politician, you know, the first, I mean, to be honest, I think the first thing they will do is be like, oh, we're not gonna make it fair now. Now, after 10 years of being locked out? Like, I mean, that's what's gonna happen unless we build in structural reforms. And it just goes back and forth. And so we don't, again, because we don't have a ballot initiative process in this state, it frees fairness groups from having to commit to a certain vision of fairness, which is very politically advantageous. Because once you have to commit to an actual plan, then there's going to be people who don't like it for one reason or another. But I would say, in general, states that have an independent commission, there's two models. There's the Iowa model, where you have retired judges. I think Iowans like that pretty well, actually. It's very popular there. I have no impression it's under serious threat. People like the system. The other thing, which is what they're, interestingly enough, this is what they put on the ballot in Michigan, so we'll see if people like it, is a citizens commission, where actually citizens are chosen kind of like a jury. Like, there are kind of citizens who are chosen, and they sort of form a commission, and they're, and you know, a certain number of registered Democrats, a certain number of registered Republicans, a certain number of registered independents, and they sort of get together and do the math. So that's a pretty innovative proposal. It'll be interesting to see if people buy it, but that's what's on the ballot in Michigan, so we'll see. I forgot what the Colorado is. But those are, I think, are the two main models that people have for independent commission.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. Greet your neighbors. Join us not only for coffee, but today we have cookies. Thank you.